Why should modern Christians read the Minor Prophets? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host for this series of lessons on the Minor Prophets, and my conversation partners are Dave Thomas, who is Dean of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University, and a longtime friend and former colleague, John Dibdall, who was also in the School of Theology and was also president at Walla Walla College at one time. So want to welcome both of these men. Let's start with that leading question. Why should modern Christians read the Minor Prophets?
Well, they're not really minor. I mean, when most people hear that word, they think it means unimportant. And it has more to do with size of the book, certainly for the Hebrews and for the early Christians, I would think, that they were just as important as any of the other longer prophets. But just because they're shorter doesn't mean they're less important. And I would say that get rid of that name. That would be helpful, number one. And then number two, I would say that the message that they give is surprisingly relevant when we examine it in its depth.
Okay.
And I would say something similar, that prophets, minor and major for that matter, offered fairly frank and biting social and religious commentary that never goes out of date.
Okay. Now, I should mention that around this table, as we are recording, that we have a fair bit of experience as ministers in the Adventist Church. John Dibdall and I both became employees 1965, and Dave Thomas, he's just a kid. He started in 1977, but you add that up, it's quite a bit of time. And my two colleagues here, John and Dave, have taught Hebrew prophets more so than I have. But I'm very much interested in some of the questions that we are dealing with here. And I perhaps should give you just a bit of a background. As I worked on the study guides for these lessons, I discovered, it was helpful for me to discover, that most of these minor prophets, and the book is just called the Book of the 12 in Judaism, so there are 12, they are clustered around three major events in Judaism. One is before the fall of the Northern Kingdom. 722, they disappeared off the face of the earth, and there are a number of prophets that focus in on that event before it happens. Another cluster, just before the fall of the Southern Kingdom, fall of Jerusalem and the beginning of the exile, and then another cluster of three dealing with the restoration period, trying to get the temple started and those kinds of things. So we're going to be starting here with Hosea, but I'd like to focus on a bit more. Well, let me take one question here that I'd like to explore. The tough stuff in the prophets is really difficult for me to handle, personally. I'll admit that. When Jesus said, love your enemies, I want to be able to do that. And sometimes when I read the prophets, I get the impression that God doesn't really care a lot for the enemies. Now, how do you men deal with that when you teach the prophets? The very strong language against the enemies when Jesus said, love your enemies.
Well, I think you have to answer that at two levels. One is the judgment and the harsh judgment that fall upon God's people, Israel and Judah. That's one issue. And then the other issue is the nations, because they're dealt with as well. It isn't just Israel that's dealt with. It's the nations that are dealt with. And you just have to think several things that I would give just briefly as answers. Number one, I think that culturally they're different. There tends to be more radical kinds of things said, and sometimes even with a bit of rhetorical flourish that you may not necessarily need to take exactly literally. You know.
Perhaps, John, I could just interrupt there a bit. The first president of Walla Walla College, Sutherland, says if you want the train to come, if you want the caboose to come up to the platform, the engine has to shoot way beyond.
Okay.
So what you're suggesting, there may be some some lively overstatement.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think that the prophets are full of hyperbole. They're being very, very dramatic. They're like firemen who come to a house that's on fire and you're all sitting eating breakfast without paying attention, and they smash the door down. Well, do they really need to smash the door down? It will get your attention, see.
Mm-hmm. Well, most, let's be honest, a lot of preachers, you know, in the heat of the moment, under the inspiration of the moment, the people there trying to make the point, trying to make it clear, may overstate just a little bit.
And sometimes a lot.
And sometimes a lot. I think that's one thing to remember. The other thing to remember is that you have to wound before you can heal in this case. Mm-hmm. A lot of the things that are going on are things that, whether they're ignorance or just plain inattention or just the way culture is and what's happening with people, I think to get people to recognize there's a problem, you have to dramatize what the problem is. And I think that's another issue that's taking place here. And of course, I think in the end, most of the prophets in the end come to passages of renewal and healing. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they wound in order to bring restoration and healing. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to get used to that other stuff and relate to it that way and wait for the final end of the story rather than getting waylaid in the middle before you've heard what the final punchline is.
Yeah. Okay.
And see, I think there's also the matter of inertia, that here people are stuck in various ruts. How do you get them out? Well, you, in the case of the prophet, you scream and shout and holler and yell and do dramatic things in order to get people to have a sense that they need to move.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, Hosea was speaking before the fall of the Northern Kingdom. The Northern Kingdom fell in 722. The Assyrians came and wiped them out. Hosea and Amos both were speaking at a time at the highest prosperity under the time of Jeroboam II. There was a great deal of wealth and a great deal of social injustice going on at that time. So Hosea is told by the Lord, and this is where I'd like to focus on. Next week we're also going to be doing Hosea, but what I'd like for us to focus on here is the story with which the book opens. Hosea is commanded to marry a prostitute. And out of that marriage, it is to be a lesson to Israel. She, in fact, goes back to her prostitution, and Hosea then is instructed to go win her back. And that is supposed to be a vivid illustration for the people. My question is that too strong for an Anglo-Saxon crowd today?
You understand why nobody volunteered to be a prophet. He was used, I mean, it wasn't only his words, but his life became a drama of the relationship of God to his people. One, you know, in Hosea's case, it was an actual real relationship with his wife, illustrating the spiritual connection between ancient Israel and God. So I think it's a tough road.
Yeah.
But I think the dynamic is different than our day, too. You know, in the patriarchal society, people didn't view sexuality the way we view it. So.
Well, and you notice children are involved as well. It's not just...
That's true, they are. Even
wife.
Their names.
And he named his kids.
Yeah, he named his kids after it. And there's been a lot of discussion as to exactly how to take that, because some people are really bothered by the fact that God would order somebody to do something like this. And so... there have been many ways to try to soften or get around it, and I'm not sure any of them are particularly helpful. Although the word, I think, in the original statement where he says for him to take a wife, it isn't actually meaning of the word prostitute. The usual meaning of prostitute is someone with a tendency, looseness, and a tendency toward that. So we're not sure that she was a prostitute before. It seems clear that she was later.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, that's not exactly clear. But that does not... that does not detract, I think, from the core message of the story.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was taking a course in Jeremiah, Hebrew readings in Jeremiah in Edinburgh under a J.C.L. Gibson, a very devout Scot. And the sexual imagery in the first six chapters there, he just kind of blurted out one day. He says, I think I'm going to pick a different section next time. He says, this is just getting too much. They were just plain outright open and used much greater freedom than we had today. So you think it – are you men prepared to say that it was a real story, that it really happened, not just a metaphor?
I read it that way.
Yeah, I read it that way. I don't think that we can tell exactly or make a huge deal out of it. I think whichever way it happens, it's real. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was – if she had a tendency toward it and later became that, whatever – I don't think that makes a huge difference to the basic core of what it's trying to say.
Now, the practical question I have is, does this story suggest that we ought to be more gentle and more forgiving with pastors who go astray in sexual areas today?
That's an interesting question because you're switching around. It wasn't Hosea who was a prostitute. You're
That's
saying
true. You turned the tables
astray. You turned... You turn the male-female thing around, so that does make, I would think, a little bit of difference.
But do you think the conference these days, the employing body, would be happy to maintain a pastor whose wife has turned into a prostitute?
I don't know.
That may be no reflection on him.
Yeah. I think it would be, discussed. Certainly the matter would be talked about. But I think that if the man was... good man, or the woman was a good woman and the spouse was not what they ought to be, I think that there might be some understanding.
Okay. Do you see any evidence, the two of you, you've had long experience in the church, that we may be more gracious in this?
I think we are.
Okay.
I think we are.
Last question. The rules that we have in the Bible, it seems to me, are sometimes... not followed with any kind of precision. For example, the rules against incest in the Pentateuch wouldn't apply to Abraham. And I believe there is a rule in Deuteronomy 24:4 that says if a man divorces a wife and she marries someone else, he can't under any circumstances bring her back again because that would be an uncleanness. Is that a proper reading of the Old Testament?
I don't know if it's a proper reading of the Old Testament, but I don't think we read it that way. Certainly, I think our current practice does not read it that way. I think if a person wants to remarry a person that they once were married to, I don't think that we would consider that to be a problem, would we?
I don't think so, but I don't understand this purity-impurity element of sexuality in ancient times. You know, there seems to have been a ritual... or symbolic meaning to human sexuality that's missing today. Does immorality produce impurity? Mm-hmm. I guess morally speaking it does.
Well, we'll need to pick up that question next week because our time is just about up. I would like to thank John and Dave for helping. My thanks also to Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer, and thanks to you for listening in for The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.